So we know our sensations in our bodies can really give us clues, can bring us back to that, you know, help us with the good triggers. You know, we know we get triggered with reactive patterns, but they can also help trigger our mindfulness. Go, oh, I'm feeling that in my body. You remember Sister Dee last week in her book excerpt, and she's talking about finding that trigger in your, just being aware of something happening in your body, not even really knowing or identifying what it is or where it's coming from, but just allowing you to stop. You know, just something that needs my attention. So there's a teaching of the Buddha called dependent origination. To me, this is like the most challenging of all the teachings. It's like there's a book called The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, and we've worked with that book several times. And years ago, some of us worked with it. And when we got to that chapter, it was kind of like everyone said, "Do we have to know this?" Can we skip this chapter? And the answer is yes, you can skip it. No. But I want to talk about it a little bit because it, again, you know, whatever seeds might go in and sprout sometime later, you know. So Alan Wallace said, "All phenomena are dependently related events arising in a network of mutual entanglement." So that makes sense to me. It seems like there are so many things happening at once. Like someone will, you know, someone will say, "I'll take a new supplement," and they'll say, "Well, how did it work?" "I don't know. I take so much stuff. I have no idea." You know, so even just identifying something like that, but there's so much input and so much going on and so many layers. It's that I like that mutual entanglement, you know. So this has a lot of different names. It's called dependent origination or dependent co-arising or interdependent origination. I think this is, Thay coined that phrase, interbeing, to reflect some of this. And the Buddha said it this way: this is because that is. So I find that really helpful. It's causes and conditions mutually entangling. So I'd like to give us an example. There's 12 links, but it doesn't always have to be 12. You can do a few. So I'm going to start this example. And so that it, you know, why this can be helpful is that we're trying to get more and more subtle in our awareness, you know, of when something starts to trigger, you know, a feeling, idea, thought, a story, a mental formation, a pattern. And the sooner we can catch it, the less chance it has to entangle us. So I'll give you an example of how these links are described and work. So this can really help free us, you know, from the slavery of reactivity. So we'll start with contact, which is really like the fifth or sixth step on this, of these links. But say contact is an encounter between sensory faculties and a stimulus. So there's a, you know, just like we studied last time, there's an object and there's an organ or a base, okay? So we're gonna use the example of sound waves activating receptors in us. That's just, there's just contact, that's all there is. And then the next step is it ignites mental engagement. But there's no conceptual framework yet, so we just hear noise. You know, it's before you've identified anything. It's just the sound waves come, receptors accept it, and there's noise. Okay. Then the third one is recognition. So we put some recognition to it. The raw sound becomes familiar. So this is where our perceptions come in, our labeling, you know. So we start to get into trouble here. But so we recognize it, lawnmower. Okay. So then a feeling arises at the same time. It's a pleasant, an unpleasant, or a neutral feeling. Or we could use leaf blower, which I think might even be more. So it's flavoring our apprehension of it, of the, our, you know, apprehending the object, you know, this sound. It's a lawnmower, and we have a feeling about it. And then the feeling is affected by our attitude. Okay, I'm sitting in meditation, or I'm trying to drink my tea. The lawnmower noise is going to interrupt me, is interrupting me. So then what happens? You know, begin to feel more feelings. And then the next one is desire arises. I hope it stops. And then the next one is, you know, there's more feelings, like anger could arise, irritation towards the gardeners, towards whoever's doing this, towards who's, you know, infecting my world with this noise I don't want. And then clinging comes. I won't be happy until it stops. So that's codependent, you know, co-arise, independent origination, interdependent origination. So, and then this all leads to our intention, you know. And then we start creating these stories about it. I hate leaf blowers. And I hate people who use them, you know. And then we have, then all of a sudden we're completely separate from a whole category of people in the world, you know. So then, if we bring mindfulness to this process, the earlier the better, then we have the freedom to choose. You know, it can remain neutral, or we can remain with our feelings. You know, we don't have to project them out in the world. We don't have to get caught in the duality of, like, you know, I won't be happy until, and I hate those people, and, you know, all that pushing away that happens because we're unhappy. So it really is wonderful. So the three aspects of it that I want to focus on are impulse, desire, and clinging. So these are these three steps. So with impulse, it's like impulse is like the first sensation. The impulse toward it or away from it, basically. So we can, this is what we did in our meditation. When we train ourselves to be aware of the subtle movement of our minds and bodies towards something or away from it, we can start right there in identifying our reaction to impulse. And then it doesn't even have to create, go into a whole big story. So then, if we have not caught it there, then it goes into desire. Desire or craving. So then we begin to notice, I'm experiencing a desire. I'm experiencing a desire for this thing to stop. You know? And then when we start noticing that, one of the great insights that we can have is, it doesn't have to stop in order for my suffering to stop. Because we have this thing about the world has to be the way. Well, it's reasonable. These leaf blowers are terrible, you know. Who could meditate with a leaf blower going, you know, this whole story, and we don't have, oh my gosh, I can meditate with a leaf blower noise. It just becomes a noise, you know. And so there's a freedom that happens, you know. But sometimes it goes away. Sometimes our desire goes away. I mean, I feel this. Sometimes I have something called a lurking desire. I'll go through the whole process, and it's like, okay, it's gone. And then it's like I take my mind away for 1 second. It comes back, you know. It's like, I really do want that cup of tea. I knew I wanted it. It's not going to go away till I have it, you know. So, you know, that's us. That's who we are, you know. It's waiting for that moment of distraction, you know. But we can identify that desire or craving is just the wanting part, okay? That's sort of natural. And the Buddha says there's a juncture between desire and clinging, between craving and attachment. So the third step, we find ourselves drinking the tea, you know, eating the cake, whatever. It's like, okay, I've gone through impulse, I've gone through desire, here I am, you know. And so then we just notice. We just notice our level of attachment to the satisfaction of this desire, which just came from an impulse. And we also can notice, are we really attached to the object, or are we more attached to the desire for it? Sometimes we're more attached to the desire, because you sometimes when you do that, you want something, and then you have it, and you think, oh, this isn't so great, you know. I thought this was going to taste better, you know. But it's like there's an attachment to the desire. I believe that my desire has to be fulfilled. And so then you can look at, where does this attachment come from? Where does this clinging, this need come from? And maybe it comes from deprivation. You know, it's like, if I don't get that thing, I'm going to feel deprived. You know, and I deserve it. So I'm having it. And also it can come from the need to shore up your sense of identity. Well, I'm the kind of person who has a cup of tea every morning. That's who I am. And it's good for me, I've been told that. So, you know, it's like, but it's like, what is it doing? It's shoring up that identity in a very slight way. So there's nothing wrong with it, with the action. But it is helpful to identify the clinging or the attachment to that as a part of ourself. And, you know, a key to that is how do you react when you don't have it, you don't get it? How do you feel? And that's a really rich place to practice with. I mean, I remember one time we were in Plum Village, and they're very, there's not any, how do I say this? There's no unskillfulness around spending too much money on things in our tradition, in our Plum Village community. They're very frugal. And so a lot of times, if you're at Plum Village at a big retreat, you get there late in line for dinner, there's no food. No. They do not make over, you know, an amount over. And if people are piling their plates up high, then the people at the end aren't going to get food. And so one time, I remember this happened a couple of times in a row, you know. And I felt like, I remember standing there feeling like, I'm going to starve to death. And it was just like, no, come on, you know. It's like, you could do without a few meals. It would probably be really good for you. But it was like, I felt like I was going to starve to death. I felt like it was a very deep feeling. And it was so funny because there were a group of us, like maybe 8 or 10 of us at the table, and there was really no food left. And so we're standing there, and I think we were all feeling somewhat that way. So this nun came out, and we said, there's no food. So she went into the kitchen, and she came out with this huge wheel of brie. And she said, will this do? This was before they went vegan. And we're going, yeah. So we like had this big wheel of French brie. It was incredible, you know. But it was just, the feelings were really interesting that came up in me, like really primal, you know. So it's really rich to see, you know, what happens. So I'd like to talk a little bit about perception. Because, you know, this is that step in the creation of the links where we get caught. Perception is where we label things. Usilananda says, perception is the mental process of assigning meaning to sensations that come through all the sense doors. So we have the impulse, we have it come in, and then it's that recognition place. Oh, lawnmower. And you can see where that starts getting us into trouble. Because automatically then you think, like, don't like. You know, you start assigning and categorizing what these things are. So it's a progression which can entangle us with fetters. You know, we can form knots. So it interprets evidence by recognizing and remembering the distinguishing marks of something, like hot, cold, man, woman. It's recognizing the duality in our world. And we have to remember that our perceptions are not absolutes, you know. It's that old thing that I talked about, the point of view. We only are coming from one point in our view. And so that's where our perception comes from. And the trouble comes when we believe that our perceptions are accurate. You know, I think it's pretty amazing. I don't know if science has any way of determining, but I don't think we know if the blue you see is the same blue that I see. You know? It's like we really don't know. You know? So one of the three doors of liberation, the Buddha has three doors of liberation, and one of them is called signlessness. And this is not getting caught in our perceptions, not getting caught in the sign of thing, not seeing that and not having to call it table and believing this is table and everybody has to know that that's table because I do and that's our world. So it's a way of becoming free of feeling so sure about ourselves and our perceptions. So our perceptions are colored by several things. They're colored by our karmic predispositions. If you just think about some roadkill, and you know, if you bring that to mind, there might be probably a little aversion, a little turning away, especially if it's maggot-ridden, you know. But what if you were a vulture? Breakfast. Oh boy, you know. So it depends on where you're coming from, you know. And then cultural conditions, of course, you know. So a holy martyr to some might be a suicide bomber or a terrorist to others. I really like this phrase that Larry Ward said. When I see you, I participate in creating what I see. And when you see me, you participate in creating what you see. So this is a mindfulness bell to me to realize, you know, I'm necessarily projecting my filter, my knots, my view of the world onto you. You know, we know that. We see somebody and somewhere back in the depths of our consciousness, you know, some mannerism or some look, some energy reminds us of somebody. You know, none of this is even conscious and we have a predisposition immediately to this person or away from this person. So we realize that we're bringing our whole story and all of our filters of the way we see the world to any engagement with anybody else. So if we own them, you know, and we, you know, this is what we've been doing with this whole sutra, is bringing that curiosity and that openness and that suspension of judgment, you know. So this is what the Buddha's reminding us to do, you know. Become aware that you're bringing this whole set of stuff to the moment, and as much as possible, release it. You know, as much as possible, just suspend it. You know, I know you probably means a lot to you because you've been carrying this bags around for a long time, and they are you. But just for now, just temporarily suspend them. You know, let go and just be light and curious and open when you greet someone. And I think we've probably all had the experience of being greeted by somebody like that. You know, think of the Dalai Lama. It's like, how wonderful, how free, you know. You feel seen and heard by that person like that. So it's really good if you have perhaps a difference of opinion or even an argument with someone to stop and think, okay, why do they have that point of view? Why do they see things differently than I do? You know, what's caused that to be different? And then when you can begin to understand that, compassion naturally arises. When understanding begins, compassion arises for them and also for yourself and also just for this world. Boy, you know, we're all, you know, sometimes it's amazing to me we communicate at all. You know, we're all coming from our little different spots, you know, and our different ways of seeing things and our different ways of articulating. And so to just have some space and some compassion for that, for all of us doing our best. Thay gives us the mantra, are you sure, to work with our perceptions. No. Many of us have worked with this before, but it's a really excellent little mantra to remember to continually question our perceptions. No. So through careful investigation and mindfulness, we can train ourselves to be aware of our perceptions, and to let them go, or at least to acknowledge and recognize the part they're playing in creating our view. You know? And then we begin to take responsibility for the biases that we bring. You know? I know I read this quote before, but I really like it by teacher Sylvia Boorstein. And she says, what the Buddha promised is that human beings like himself and like us can change the habits of our mind by paying attention to these habits. And not just change our thoughts and views, we can actually change the way we process our thoughts and views. We can become free of identities that are constricting and views that hold happiness hostage. We can be authentically and kindly wise. So this is what we're doing. We're really looking at the process by how we come to our views. And through this questioning, through this investigation and careful attention to how an impulse becomes a desire, becomes a craving, becomes a view, you know, how we can hold that lightly and not be so influenced, not be so blown around by it. So the Buddha had this really great thing. He said there's four hallucinations of perception. And I really like this because it's like, yeah, it's like not only are our perceptions coloring our view, but they're causing us to hallucinate. And they're hallucinations because not only do we perceive them, but we believe that they're true. You know, we really believe that these things are real. So the four things are, and we've studied some of these already. The first one won't be too big of a surprise. We believe what is impermanent to be permanent. So that's our first hallucination. Okay. So I always bring that home to, do I really believe I'm going to die? Nope. I still don't. You know, or how much do I really know? How much do I really embody the reality of impermanence, you know. And then the second one is we believe what is unattractive to be attractive. So that might be different for each of us. What are we attracted to that's really not attractive? And one of the things, an image that came to me was, if you've ever seen a young girl that has really heavy makeup on, you know, and she's doing it to be attractive. And don't you want to just wash your face? Go, you'd be so much, so pretty if you just got all rid of all that makeup, you know. So it's really believing. It's like, and you can sort of explore for yourself. What are these things that you sort of are society and personally you take to be attractive that really aren't, you know. And then the third one is, we believe suffering to be happiness. And this is really the sensual pleasures pathway, you know. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with having whatever. You know, I always use the piece of cake thing. There's nothing wrong with having a wonderful little piece of cake. But there probably is something that's going to cause suffering if you eat the whole cake in one sitting. So it's like the trouble with that is we don't know where to stop. You know, because, and especially in our society, you know, more, 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 more. So we tend to take that, and then it creates suffering. So becoming more aware of really what is really the cause of our happiness, and what is the cause, what turns to suffering. And then the fourth one, of course, is the key one, which is we believe non-self to be self. We identify ourselves as separate, you know. We identify this heap of perceptions and feelings and thoughts that we have as this separate thing. We create stories about ourselves, you know, when it's really only a passing mind state. There was this great story that Joseph Goldstein told about how one time he was meditating and he was you know, in a long retreat, and what was coming up for him was a lot of fear. And it was just, you know, fear, fear, fear for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Fear, and not just in the meditation, but also when he was not formally meditating. And he could just really, he got in touch with a really, you know, heavy knot of fear in him. And so he began to feel like, wow, I'm really a fearful person, you know. And this is going to really take a long time to work through, and I'm going to have to go to therapy, and, you know. And he really got into this thing, and so he was with his co-teacher, Sharon Salzberg, and they're walking along, and he was telling this whole experience of all this. And she just turned to him, and she said, Joseph, it's just a passing mind state. And he just, like, the whole, like, bubble popped. It's like he had created this whole years of therapy, and now I'm going to do this. And for him, I mean, you know, at some other moment that might not have been appropriate, would have been denying his feelings or something, but this was perfect. This was the perfect thing to pop that bubble and just, like, yeah. So how we invest in these stories about ourselves. Michael Martone says, in the stories we tell ourselves, we tell ourselves.
We what?
We tell ourselves. In the stories that we tell ourselves, we tell ourselves. So it's really important to be aware of the stories that we have and that we believe about ourselves, you know. We're wonderful storytellers. I remember Jean Houston one time asked an Aboriginal woman, an elder, she said, what makes us human? And the Aboriginal woman said, oh dear, we're the ones who tell the stories about all the others. And I love that. You know, stories are wonderful and stories can heal. And I have to say that one time when I was, you know, facing this medical diagnosis and I thought, oh, I might die a lot sooner than I thought, one of the things that passed through my mind was, I'm going to really miss those books and movies that are coming out. I'm going to be here because I really love stories, you know. So here's a really interesting exercise that you might want to do on your own. Label your top 10 stories about yourself.
<My goodness. laughs>
Okay, so we're going to do a meditation.